We lost like 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
The kids were not amused.
Yeah.
They're still not amused about that.
We have some of these real people. I mean, you have to have this one tracker to run on Casper Diva. I don't remember.
Yeah, so, right. So we were relying on, I forget. I think after that, it was like, okay, we have to get them on both of us. I still don't know if that happened. But, you know, that was probably the biggest snafu of the whole trip. Like, that's the biggest snafu.
Yeah,
and
that's
crazy what it's saying.
Right. So, I hope we got to get some good food.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Thank you so much.
Oh.
So there's still time for you to go to some.
That's right, yeah.
A little too short of that.
Yeah. I don't know how much money we had in the budget. Should we do that?
I do want to go back to the station.
Yeah, that was my experience as well. That I worked out and then didn't worry. Then we went to the left. I think we're going to be back.
Oh, are you?
Yes, I'm sure.
Good for you. Yeah, we also. Not that we left anything on the floor, but like I would love to do my own class. We didn't get up there in the morning. I could do well in 3 more. It's easy.
Yeah. A lot of good eating.
Yeah. There's a lot to see. Every time you turn it on, it's like 7,000.
I know. It really is. And Naples felt this way too. It's fantastic. People have been living on top of each other for over 2,000 years. It's just.
It's astonishing.
It's not like the American mind on this way.
No, I can't.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm from the United States. We have about 30 seconds to the alarm off.
Ready? Is anybody not presenting? Who's presenting? Oh my God.
Good to see you.
Oh my God.
Chat in a whole world.
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
So, you're speaking? All right. I got about 30 seconds to make this happen, so pay attention. This function with this remote goes up, goes down. Please bring it up to your height. Try not to adjust the microphone, but speak into it and speak like you mean it, because they cannot hear you unless you kind of use your voice. The sound in this room goes up, not in. They all have their own speakers, but it only gets said if it's into this microphone. Time is here. We're good? Any questions? You're not eating, you're not drinking, you have gum in your mouth. All right, let's make the wheel turn. Your notifications on your phone is off, you're not the paparazzi.
Thank you.
What's that?
Sometimes things are floating through our head.
Say that one.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm looking at what I was doing. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. What's that? Center it, yeah. They're just going to push it aside, but let them push it aside. Put it right on the center. His notepad. There you go. It's going to push it, but that's okay. Or her notepad. I forget. It's just a cross key. All right.
Okay, here we go.
I take it back. We're going to be late.
Please be seated. We are here in court for Rule Petition 2301 in the matter of amending Wisconsin Statute Section 80912 relating to appellate review of motion pending appeal. God bless you.
Thank you.
We have presenters, Caleb Gerbitz, James Sisnaki, sorry, and James Goldschmidt, 10 minutes apiece. Let's start out with Mr. Gerbitz.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for taking the time to consider this rule petition. My colleague, James Sisnaki, and I brought this petition to address an issue that has come up more and more frequently in Wisconsin's appellate court, the issue of the standard of review for a stay pending for...
And counsel, that's one of the questions that I have. How often is this coming up? Is this really a big deal that we need this change?
Well, Your Honor, we've had at least a few instances in the last several years that are referenced in our brief. There's the Wadey case, the Gall case is one case that was not referenced in our brief that came up last term. There was the County of Dane case from a couple terms ago. And I think even if it doesn't come up all that terribly often, actually, let me back up. And before I say that, say this. It's not easy to tell how often this comes up, because most often you'll have an appeal from the circuit court to the Court of Appeals, where there will be a decision from the Court of Appeals that's ultimately unpublished. So there's no good data on how often this comes up. But even if it doesn't come up that often, it's worth clarifying it for the few times it does come up. Because if this comes up in the future and the standard of review is still unclear, it's going to leave the panel at the Court of Appeals or this court in an uncertain spot. So our submission is that it makes sense to clarify that now in a less adversarial setting and more importantly, in a less rushed setting. This is a difficult question of law that we think is especially well suited to be resolved on a rule petition rather than on a rushed one-week decision timetable that often accompanies the stay pending appeal analysis. Now, I'm not aware...
If it weren't a rushed 1 week, is it your position that it would better be the subject of case law development than a rules petition?
If it were not rushed 1 week, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a horse apiece, to be honest. I think if the court had several weeks to address, if the court had, you know, a regular merits case to address it, that would be good, but I don't think it'd be any better than the rule petition process. You have advocates here, some for, some against, that have spent time thinking about this. Your Honors have taken briefing on this, thought about this. So I don't think you'll be in any more informed a position now than you would be if it was in the common law case, in like a regular case. The other point I'll make is that even if it was in the context of a normal case, you would have a court of appeals that would be going first, typically, and the court of appeals would be bound by the current precedent, which is a little unclear, so we think that there would be benefit in you weighing in now so that the court of appeals has the guidance going forward.
When things are unclear, though, from one case, isn't it typical that we would develop that through law when we're presented with certain facts and circumstances? So here you're asking us to issue a rule not even being able to contemplate all the ways in which it might come into play.
Well, that's true for every rule of procedure, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, I don't know of any that are this only 2 years after a appellate, 2 years after a decision on our part wanting to go ahead, or a few years after a decision on our part wanting to make that into a rule. I don't know that certainly since I've been on the court, we haven't had anyone ask for that.
That's true. I would argue that there should be more rule petitions in front of Your Honor.
All right. Well, we'll count on you to bring those.
I'll keep you busy. I mean, I think this is the sort of issue that it just, given how urgently these decisions normally come up, the stay pending appeal, I mean, there's an election coming up. You're going to be asked to make decisions regarding stays pending appeal relative to that election, I have no doubt. And it's much, much easier to lay the playing field now, set the rules now, when you're not in a rushed format, and then when the time comes, you'll actually have the rule in place, rather than trying to figure this out in that rushed setting that you would have otherwise.
I think part of the problem, if I'm understanding what you're saying, is that with the rushed setting, we have to make a decision quickly. We might not have all the information we need. And here we have the benefit of being more deliberate and thinking about it when we have some time. Having said that, in reading through the materials in preparation for today, one of the things that I'm not sure happened, and I want to ask you about how you vetted this with other organizations, because it seems like almost every other organization that weighed in isn't supporting what you are saying. So one of my concerns is, if we have the time to do this, shouldn't we do it when it's been vetted to the maximum extent possible?
I mean, the rule petition process has quite a bit of vetting in place. The notice of the rule went out to a laundry list of organizations. The state bars, or the appellate practice section of the state bar, has weighed in. This is a nuanced area. I don't know how much more feedback you'd get on what the standard of review is for an appeal from a stay pending appeal decision. I think, you know, this is an area where the federal courts have tread. The federal courts have looked at this and they've adopted a standard of review that applies de novo review to conclusions of law. I don't think there's much risk to saying that now, and it would bring a lot of clarity before you get it, before it's a difficult situation. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Okay.
One of the entities that is not embracing this requested rule says we don't need it. I mean, it's pretty clear under the law that an issue of law is subject to de novo review, and that erroneous exercise of discretion includes a misstatement of fact or a misinterpretation or application of law. So, and then they continue in their argument, as I recall, saying that if you're focused on likelihood of success, that maybe it isn't just a question of law, that there's a blend in certain situations that would bring in a question of fact or discretion. Okay? How do you respond to that?
I want to start with that last thing first.
Okay.
And I'd refer to the supplemental memorandum we submitted that has the alternative language,
mm-hmm.
where we clarify that only the trial court's conclusions of law would be subject to de novo review. If the question on appeal is whether the traffic light was green or red, that's still going to be subject
sure.
to...
I mean, that's, in my mind, is boilerplate law.
Yes.
I mean, you know, oftentimes we have a deferential standard, but when we talk about an erroneous exercise of exercise of discretion, misstatement of fact, misinterpretation or application of law, you know. So don't we already have it? De novo review for a legal conclusion that's erroneous?
I'm not so sure.
I'll read my opinions. I say that half tongue in cheek.
I mean, as I read, like Wadey, for example, I read that to say we apply the erroneous exercise of discretion standard unless you've applied the wrong standard, the wrong legal standard altogether, or the Gall case then goes on to say unless you've applied no standard at all. But what happens if you applied the correct standard, you at least spoke the correct standard as the judge, but you did it incorrectly? You know, the statute says X, you said X, but then your application of X was off base. I think current precedent leaves, in that situation, deferential review applies, which is weird. It says de novo review applies if the trial court applied the wrong standard, but it doesn't apply. But deferential review does not apply if you applied the wrong standard, but it does apply if you applied the correct standard. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse, right? You're saying if your legal analysis was good, it's deferential review. If it was bad, it's de novo review. You have to figure out whether the legal analysis was correct first.
Which presents a question of law that we reviewed de novo.
Yes, I think so. And if that is the standard, as I read Wadey, that's not how I read it. I know Justice Dallet had a dissent saying that isn't the standard in this, that shouldn't be the standard for that first element. The appellate practice section's brief, pages 2 and 3, describe the standard as you just articulated it. That's not how I've read the case law, and the fact that there's that confusion, I think, warrants cleaning up. Unless there are any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sosnowski?
Thank you, Your Honors. I won't detain you very long. Caleb and I have very similar positions on this, so I don't want to retread ground. I do want to address something briefly that both Justice Protasiewicz and Justice Ann Walsh Bradley brought up about the need petition. And not to belabor the points that Attorney Gerbitz mentioned, the fact that federal courts have addressed this issue indicates that it is an issue that is coming up. So I think that goes to the need to address this on the front end. And, kind of on a related point, this would be a very easy clarification for the court to make. on the standards. And I understand that, you know, the rules of appellate procedure at this point have not codified any standards of review. But I think that's because most standards of review are relatively straightforward and don't, to some degree, befuddle experienced attorneys, as you've seen some of the back and forth between both the appellate practice commission's writing and then our brief. So it's an area that the court could provide clarity. And I think the back and forth illustrates that. I think it's arguable, to your point, that this standard of review does already exist to some degree. Like, I think it's a fair inference from Wadey and these other decisions, but it's not clear, and it's that clarity that I think this rule change could offer.
Counsel, first of all, I should have said it to first counsel. Thank you for bringing this. You know, this is an issue that I appreciate you taking the time to explore. The standard of review does, as you noted, doesn't appear in any other provision in 809, standard of review, 809 being the rules of appellate procedure. And one of the filings indicate that what you're trying to do is substantive, not procedural. And, of course, we have rules that say we don't effectuate substantive law through enactment of our Supreme Court rules. Can you address that, please?
Sure, Your Honor. I don't believe that this is substantive because it really gets to the heart of the standard of review question, is how does an appellate court review the trial court's conclusions of law? And I would echo what Attorney Gerbert said about the current standards not making that clear. But this doesn't substantively decide anything. This simply says what I think is the reasonable view of the current standard, which is, you know, courts are not going to defer to the legal conclusions of the circuit court. So I guess I don't see how that could be a substantive rule rather than a simply clarifying the standard of review and making what was said in Wadey clearer.
It's a red flag for me that no standard of review appears any place else in 809. It's not dispositive, of course, but it raises a question for me. Why should we have one in this area? And is it really, you know, is it substantive? So when I look at the rules of appellate procedure, oftentimes it's telling you, you know, you do this, attorney, you do this, litigant, you do this. And yet what you're talking about is courts. This is how you do it. And that just seems a little different. And I'm wondering that if it doesn't appear anyplace else, maybe you shouldn't be. Maybe there is a substantive component, a flavor, a blend of substantive, as opposed to when and where to file a motion for intervention and voluntary dismissals and all of that kind of thing that we find in 809. What about a blend?
If I'm going to try to address what I think your question is. I think your question is, if we haven't addressed standard review anywhere else in 809, why should we do it here?
No, that's only part of it.
Okay.
We haven't addressed it in 809 anyplace else, which for me raises a red flag, and that maybe it isn't so purely procedural, because in other provisions of 809, it's telling the litigants or it's telling the attorneys, primarily, this is how you do it. This is how you file an intervention. This is when you what the brief should be. This is what the appendix has to say in your brief. This is et cetera. You know, and so it's telling attorneys, not the court. This flows over into what the court's going to do and how the court should do it. And so maybe it isn't so purely procedural. That's. Have I clarified the question at all? If not, do your best.
I will certainly try, Your Honor. So I think this court telling lower courts how they are to review cases is something that's pretty standard. And I'm not aware of anything that would prevent this from being addressed within the context of a rule petition. And I guess I don't see it as much of a red flag that this hasn't been addressed before, because I think I mentioned this earlier. Standards of review tend to be pretty straightforward. You know, questions of law get reviewed de novo. Questions of fact get reviewed for clear error and whatnot. Whereas here, it's kind of a complicated question of whether or not the stay pending appeal is going to be granted or not. There's a bunch of interlocking issues, some of which are legal, some of which are discretionary, and some of which are factual. And one point of agreement I would express with the appellate practice section's brief is they at one point they bring up that distinguishing between questions of fact, questions of law, is something that courts are well experienced with. And I would agree with that. But what we're asking for in this rule change is something a little bit different, which is not, we trust courts to make those determinations about what are legal issues. It's just making it clear that legal issues are going to be reviewed de novo, just as they are in every other standard of review. I hope that answers your question to some degree.
Thank you.
Counsel, just a comment and then a question. I think one thing that I find really interesting here is just how much people disagree about what the law is, which I think, you've very least flagged an issue that I think this court needs to think quite a bit more about, whether or not, this court chooses to adopt your exact petition or not. I think there's some real questions here that need to be thought through a little bit. So my question to you is, taking a step back, what do you conceive of, what generally speaking is a court doing when it reviews a motion for stay pending appeal? Like, what's the goal of it? Because at the end of the day, I think, we're in this kind of interesting land where you have a decision that's been made but is not yet going to be the final decision in a case, and the court is asked to provide some interim relief. How do you think through that? Because all these sort of factors and the process that courts use and how would they frame them, and there's some disagreements about how exactly you structure it or frame it. The Ninth Circuit looks at, the scope of an injunction, which we've never really talked about that. Maybe we should. I mean, there's all kinds of interesting factors, that play into that. But what are we trying to do? What should we be trying to do?
From the standpoint of the appellate courts,
I
understand your question. As Wade and the other case law recognizes, it's fundamentally reviewing what is mostly a discretionary decision by the court. There's all this weighing that involves factual determinations, and the appellate court's not coming there and second guessing any of those things. But ultimately, if the circuit court's grounds for granting the injunction, if it doesn't have any legal grounds for it, then that should stop the analysis right there. I mean, the ability to grant a stay pending appeal, it can in some cases be dispositive essentially as to the parties, maybe not legally, but where there's a time element to it, practically whether that stay is granted or not will decide the merits as to those parties. And it's important that, I think what appellate courts are well equipped to do and what they should be doing under these standards is at least ensuring that those legal grounds are meritorious enough, or there's enough of a likelihood of success that is warranted to grant the stay.
In some sense, it almost seems like the big picture, the way I might conceive of it, though I stand to be refined on this a bit, is courts are trying to make sure nothing gets screwed up too much before a case is finally decided. And we have different ways, and when you think about the balancing that occurs, right, you look at the merits, consider the different rights that are going to be impacted by some interim decision, what's reversible, what's not reversible, how's the public going to be affected, how does it impact the parties, that sort of thing. And so we come up with different ways of sort of sorting through that stuff to make sure nothing gets, like I said, screwed up, too badly. Is the main concern that you have that you think that appellate courts, and most of these are handled at the Court of Appeals, not us, probably, I think. We're often seeing some of those. But is your concern more that that you think that at least many people might think, or lawyers might think, that the standard is too deferential, that we are sort of allowing maybe a circuit court judge to have too much impact with their decision on the merit, on the legal questions that they consider, and they need a broader check from this court, and that this court and or the Court of Appeals is just too much tipping of the cap on that.
You may answer.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The short answer to your question is yes. I think that the standard, the concern is that lawyers and others will think that the standard review is too deferential. I think you're correct that the court, in its review function of these stays, is really a backstop, but one of the more important parts of that backstop is the legal determinations. It's the one area in which appellate courts are uniquely equipped to review those decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Coachman?
Good afternoon. My name is James Goldschmidt. I'm here on behalf of the Appellate Practice Section of the State Bar. Thank you for the time to for taking the time to hear from us on this proposed rule change. If you'll indulge me, I have some brief prepared remarks and then would be happy to answer any questions the court may have regarding our position. As indicated in our written comments, the appellate practice section respectfully does not support the proposed rule change. I don't plan to rehash our written comments because you can read them, but I do want to use our time today to focus on the core problem that we see with this proposal and highlight a couple of practical concerns around it as well. From our perspective, the core problem with the proposed rule change in either of its forms is its circularity. Both proposed versions of the rule say in some form that in an appellate stay analysis, the trial court's legal determinations or conclusions of law will be reviewed de novo. We're struggling with what that adds. On the one hand, it sounds like a simple statement that legal conclusions in this context will be reviewed de novo like legal conclusions in any other context, but we think the general proposition on that point is already very clear. On the other hand, if the proposal is intended to clarify that the entire likelihood of success factor under Guttenschwager is a purely legal determination, that's not what either form of the proposed rule says, and we don't think that's correct, at least in most cases. So we're left with what the proposed rule says, which is that when reviewing likelihood of success, the court will independently review conclusions of law, but with no indication of what those conclusions of law actually are. That's the circularity I'm referring to, and it's the primary reason we think the rule won't help and might hurt. If there were some consensus that the likelihood of success factor is always and only a conclusion of law to be reviewed de novo, we might view the proposal differently. But I can tell you that in the appellate practice section, we did not have that consensus even among ourselves. Instead, what we could agree on is that while it may be theoretically possible to construct a scenario where likelihood of success would be a purely legal issue, most cases will be more complex. And as long as there's a reasonable debate over the extent to which likelihood of success on the merits is purely a legal question or a more complex balancing exercise, this proposal will not help resolve that debate because it does not come down on one side or the other. Instead, it leaves open the question of which aspects of the likelihood of success analysis are conclusions of law, leaving the courts to continue that debate in each particular case. And as a result, it only, at most, restates the obvious. So far I've been focused on the circularity of the proposed rule itself, but before closing, I'd like to leave the court with two other more practical points that, in our view, also counsel against the rule, and I think to some extent go to Justice Hagedorn's question about what is it that we're trying to do here in reviewing a stay on appeal. Both go to the core rationale for the rule, and the core rationale for the proposed rule is to make it easier for the court to reflect in its initial stay ruling its initial view of the underlying merits of the case. That presents some practical concerns. First, we think that the rush of a stay request as it comes in at the outset of an appeal is the worst possible time to be forming a view of the merits that would, by definition, be premature. I'm sure we can all imagine a trial court decision that we are sure we would reverse the moment we laid eyes on it, But the fact is that these, as you know, these stay requests come to the appellate courts at a time when you have far less than all of the relevant information and are facing pressure to make a decision quickly. So under those circumstances, everything counsels in favor of awaiting the full picture, not rushing to judgment on the merits. And second, expressly tying the likelihood of success analysis too closely to how the court will ultimately rule on the merits drastically raises the stakes for your stay ruling, because it front-loads a review of the merits into the stay analysis, and we think this would have undesirable effects, both internally and externally. Internally, this would place greater pressure on the appellate courts to review the merits at the earliest possible moment with the least possible amount of information to do so, and that will make it harder and not easier to gain consensus on a stay ruling, because now everyone will view it as a proxy for the merits ruling. And simply put, and with all due respect, I don't know why you'd want to do that to yourselves or to your colleagues on the Court of Appeals. Externally, you'd have a similar problem, because the legal community and the public would also come to view every stay ruling as the handwriting on the wall for how the court will rule on the merits. Currently, we can advise our clients that the court's ruling on a stay motion doesn't mean it has prejudged the merits of the appeal. That becomes harder to say if the court adopts a rule that is expressly intended to make its stay rulings reflect its view on the merits.
In assessing the likelihood of success of the case, the first prong generally, is the circuit court to look at the composition of the court, of the appellate court or the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court, and say, not so much on the merits per se, but, you know, Ann Walsh Bradley always does this, so the likelihood of success on the merits, I don't know, you're going to get her vote. I mean, how does that approach figure into your comments that you just made or your concerns that you've raised?
There's certainly nothing in the law instructing the circuit court to take that view of the likelihood of success. But what the case law does tell us is you have to think about what the appellate court will do, not what you think of your own decision. Mm-hmm. That's weighty. And in that analysis, if the circuit judge puts himself in the shoes of the appellate court or herself in the shoes of the appellate court, is it impossible to escape that type of thinking at some level? Probably not. I think there is an aspect of the likelihood of success analysis that is in some sense probabilistic and not purely legal, and that's even before we start to get to all the other questions of discretion or fact or what have you that might also play into that analysis. I hope that answers your question. That was all I had prepared, so I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Is it your sense that appellate attorneys are reading weighty in the manner that the dissent characterized it, or in the manner that Justice Hagedorn in concurrence characterized it, or in the manner in which the majority opinion laid out the factors?
I would hope that they're reading it in the way the majority laid it out, because that would be the law as we stand here today. I think what weighty focuses on, if this is helpful, is the second of three possible tiers where a stay analysis could go wrong. As I see it, the first tier is just, did you get the test right? Did you choose Guttenschwager and apply it? That's first-order legal error if you don't do that. Nobody, I think, needs a rule to make clear that the court would review that as illegal. The second level of the analysis is what Wadey talked about, where it said, okay, you've applied, you've chosen the right test, but when we get to likelihood of success, you're thinking about how to apply that test in the wrong way. You're asking yourself as a circuit judge whether I think my own decision is right or whether I think a court of appeals will reverse it. And those are two different things. I think that's the main teaching of Wadey. You have to do the second and not the first. But then there's this third level, and it seems like that's what we're talking about here, where if you get past those two boxes, you still, at the end of the day, have to make a call on the likelihood of success on the merits, on that factor. And this court will be reviewing that third-level decision after the circuit court makes it. What we're here saying is we don't want you to adopt a rule that says that is a legal conclusion and nothing else, because we don't think that's right. But even if you, as soon as you don't say that and you just say, well, we'll review legal determinations de novo, all you're saying is what we all already know. And that's why we think the rule serves no incremental purpose.
I'm confused whether you think that this is changing the law or not, because it sounds like what you're arguing for is that this court or appellate courts should be extremely deferential to, or should be deferential into the legal, to the legal conclusions of circuit courts, right? Like if you've got a statute and, you know, the circuit court and reads the statute in some way that is at least plausible, but, you know, an appellate court might look at it and say, probably wrong. But I get it. You know, that kind of approach. It sounds like what you'd be saying is, you should actually really defer in that context and not engage in some more fulsome review of the merits, or at least purport to do it in an independent way. That deference, even on the legal determinations below, is actually what the law is. And the petitioners are saying is, that's not what federal courts do. And that's not what appellate courts should do here. And I thought you said early on you think that's an uncontrovertible proposition, or at least it's an easy proposition that we review these legal conclusions de novo. But what you're arguing for seems to be the opposite of that. I'm a little confused. What do you think the law is, and do you think this petition changes it or not?
So I can help unpack this, I hope. Yeah. What I'm saying is clear law is that legal propositions, legal conclusions, as a general matter, are reviewed de novo. That's clear. I think we all agree that's clear.
In the context of a stay, pending appeal?
As a general rule.
Yeah.
So
that is a normal rule on cases. Right,
That would apply here as anywhere else, and I think Wadey is a classic example of a case that does make that clear.
Okay.
On this first and second level that I'm talking about. So saying that again in a rule, I don't think would change the law. But then we get to this third level that I've described, where we're actually talking about the call on likelihood of success, the call itself. And I think to adopt a rule that says that's a legal conclusion that we review de novo would be a change in the law. Okay. Because we don't have a law that says that right now, and I don't think it's at least entirely accurate. Like we said, we could imagine some case where that may be true. A pure question of statutory interpretation as to whether it's constitutional or not, and that's the only question present in the case. Maybe then the likelihood of success on the merits does reduce at the end of the day to a purely legal question. But to say that across the board in all cases would be a change, and it's one we're saying the court should not make.
It seems that federal courts are pretty uniform, though, even if they phrase the test a little differently, in looking at legal questions a bit more fresh. And what you're saying is we don't and we shouldn't.
Well, I want to be clear on the deference piece as well. I'm also not saying that I think this court defers, or that the Court of Appeals defers substantially to the circuit court's legal determinations when it's looking at a stay. I believe that even now, if the court's decision below is glaringly wrong on the merits, this court will find a way to address that in the stay analysis, deference or not. But what I am saying is, at the early stage of the case, when all you've got is maybe a petition for review, or maybe a petition for an original action combined with a request for a stay, you don't have what you need to do anything more than kind of a "is this glaringly wrong" analysis, and it would be premature to go too far down the path of weighing the merits when you haven't, for example, even heard from the other side yet. That's the concern. It's not about your capacity. It's about the stage of the case.
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We gave you a little extra time.
I appreciate it.
There were two on the other side, so we wanted Justice Hagedorn to have his additional questions answered. So thank you for that. Any other presenters today in this matter? Okay, the court will adjourn, and we will reconvene in open administrative conference as soon as we're set up.
low stakes argument of your life.
Nice work.
Well done.